Yeah.
Well, good to me.
Hey, folks, thanks for tuning in to the Halloween edition of the Banff Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Lafferty, and we're here today to talk about all things spooky and or horror-related. And we got a whole big mess of people to talk about. Starting off with, we have Dr. Comics himself, Mr. Jason Tondreau.
Well, I get to be first this time. I feel honored.
Because we like you, Jason.
Thanks. My ego couldn't survive without it. Thank you.
And returning, I think this is DT's second time on the podcast. We have Mr. DT Puccino.
Hey, guys.
Hey. DT, can you give a brief introduction for our listeners who might remember you from before?
Sure. I work for Zion Press and my own imprint, which is Sketchpad Studios. I design, write, draw the Acts of Villainy line for Mutants and Masterminds 3rd Edition as a third-party person, and I've done a little bit of work here and there for Mutants and Masterminds and Hero Games.
So cool. DT is a lot of fun. Glad to have him back.
Beautiful art, by the way.
Thank you.
Amazing stuff.
Thank you very much.
And speaking of beautiful art, we have Mr. Aid Smith.
Hello there.
Thanks for joining us, Aid. I think everyone who listens to this podcast probably knows Aid and his deeply, deeply cynical and bitter views by now.
I'm not 100% cynical. I'm just like 97%
cynical. No, nobody's 100% Dave.
Exactly. Just 97%.
I once knew.
You never go full cynic.
I have my reasons.
All right, and also an artist, Mr. Walter Billiard.
I am prepared to scream like a 13-year-old cheerleader about to die.
That was weird, man. I'm not sure. But you're going with the horror theme, okay?
Horror. I mean, that's why we're here, right?
Yeah. Okay, cool.
No. I even wrote up the five indelible rules of a horror comic. I mean, come on.
I'm with you. Okay. And last but not least, before we do Walt's rules, we have Chuck Rice. Hey, Chuck.
Hi.
And Chuck, Chuck, you want to do your intro? I could do it, or you can do it, whatever.
Go ahead.
You probably know Chuck Rice from such hits as Blood and Fists and Blood and Time for RPG Objects. Made a big name back for himself in the D20 boom days, and now he works at Mayfair Press. So
Mayfair Games.
Mayfair Games, I'm sorry. That is the short version. Anything you want to add?
No, that's fine.
Cool, that works.
See you next time, do it yourself.
So, well, you have 5 rules for a horror comic?
I was kidding. I was spoofing the what the hell's the name of that movie? Scream.
Scream.
Where they say when they give the rules of a horror movie, and if you violate them, you die.
What the fuck, man?
You see.
So I think one of them is having sex. So as long as none of us have sex right now, I think we'll make it to the podcast.
And nobody should say I'll be right back.
And nobody should say too late.
Jason, save us. You're a comic scholar. What's your favorite horror comic? Do you have a favorite horror comic?
Yeah. I mean, without a doubt for me, this the best consistently good horror comic on the stands was Hellblazer. And I read John Constantine Hellblazer from issue 1. Back before there even was a Vertigo line. And then that book essentially created the Vertigo line. And then, of course, Sandman came and changed the line forever. But that book was consistently good horror. And I even got a chance to teach it a little bit. We read, the trade collection, when Constantine comes to America and has his whole New York adventure. We read that in one of my classes one time, a graphics novels course. It's interesting that book should finally be getting remade because they're the TV series has started. Have any of you seen the first episode?
Yep.
What did you think? I haven't seen it yet. It's on my list.
It was okay.
Yeah.
I mean, for a fan of Constantine, I've got a couple friends of mine that are diehard fans of Constantine, and they enjoyed it. But there's obviously things that are missing.
Yeah, like what?
Well, chain smoking.
Is he not smoking at all? I mean, I heard that they did put the smoking in.
He's on NBC, so they can't actually show him smoking.
Exactly.
So he's got a cigarette, but doesn't actually touch it or use it.
Oh, I,
Well, he butts it out at one point in time, so...
Oh, controversial. You know.
Yeah.
So he's established he's a smoker, but we never actually see him smoking.
Exactly.
I see. Interesting.
Yeah, that first episode seemed like they were trying to pack as much as they can in into one episode. The guy who's playing it is a lot of fun, but there was a recent interview that said that the girl that they rescued, that was only for the pilot, and they're bringing in a more established character. Her name begins with a Z. I can't remember what it is. Yeah, there you go. Yep. They're bringing in a more established character to be like his foil for him to talk back and forth, because they thought that the idea of Constantine being like the mentor didn't really work for the character. They said that he would be a real shitty teacher.
Yeah,
I could see a lot of story ideas with that though. But okay, I just don't. Why the fuck wouldn't you put this on cable where they can smoke and they can cuss?
Well, that's exactly it. Yeah. It doesn't make sense. I'm a massive, massive Hellblazer fan, and the Constantine comics that they brought out for New 52, just a pale comparison to the original proper Hot Hellblazer.
Yeah, they absolutely.
I just don't get why they didn't go full hog and just go, okay, HBO, here you go, make another Walking Dead for us. This is the guy, go for it. You know, it doesn't make sense. But hey.
Yeah, you would think. I mean, so who did you guys like best as a Hellblazer writer? I mean, Alan Moore had, if I'm not mistaken, a long turn on that book, and then Warren Ellis did it for a while, and there have been a bunch of other people. Who are some favorites?
Well, I think that, for me, the definitive writer probably ended up being Garth Ennis, as controversial as he is. But his run included the whole, smoking cancer plot line and lots of other great runs. Who was the first writer on Constantine?
I can't honestly remember who the hell wrote anything.
Didn't he originate in an Alan Moore Swamp Thing story?
I thought it was Alan Moore.
Moore created the character, but he didn't write the original series. That was given to somebody
else. Jamie Delano did a few. Was it him originally?
I don't remember, but I remember the story. It's funny, because I remember the first 8 issues of Hellblazer, like, virtually photographically. But I can't tell you who wrote it. It was
no. Okay. The internet says it is Jamie Delano. Okay.
Yes, win.
Win.
Sorry.
Aid gets a brownie point.
He does.
Yay.
Alan Moore created the character in Swamp Thing, and but those first 8 issues were just so great, and they established his essential mystery, and they slowly unraveled the whole plot about why he was haunted by the ghosts of all of his dead friends, and they introduced villains I'm such a gamer, I already called them NPCs. Introduced all his supporting cast members that they are even now still using on the show. I mean, that's where Zed appeared. Zed appeared in that first run of 8 issues. Those are just great stuff. And I totally agree with you that the New 52 version is so watered down. I guess you could say it's the network television version of the real...
But you're not the only one. Karen Berger, the retired editor of
Vigo,
says this isn't Constantine, this is Constantine Light.
Mm. Yeah.
We've had this discussion on Bleeding Cool for quite some time. Even the pronunciation of Constantine being one of the sticking points.
Oh, is it?
Everyone in the US seems to say Constantine. The people in the UK say Constantine.
Yeah, I heard you say that. Okay.
So,
is that how you pronounce, like Emperor Constantine of Rome?
Yeah, I think so.
Because that should be the same pronunciation. Like, the classical pronunciation is how it should be said.
Yeah, I think so. But someone went into it that it was it's not derived. It's Dutch, actually. English is something else derived. Oh, okay, fine, whatever. Anyway, some people say it one way, some people say it another way. There you go, that's the end of the thing.
Interesting.
But, so New 52, I think the New 52 version of him, the problem I found with it personally is that I wanted the New 52 version to be still that supernatural back alley stuff that you don't see in regular DC characters.
Right.
And then when they brought him in, it's like, okay, first issue, well, you're going to cross over with Superman. Next issue, you're going to be, and it's like you have the opportunity to do something a completely different. Ground street level. I mean, like you've got Marvel, you've got your street level heroes like Daredevil and Iron Fist and that kind of thing. This should be street level, ground, gritty, nasty, magic, and they decided, no, he's going to be in every crossover, he's going to be involved in the Justice League, and it just did, I don't think it works for the character.
That's yeah, eight, you're missing the thing, though. Those characters you just named, Iron Fist, Daredevil, Spider-Man, they're all in the Avengers now, and the X-Men are in the Avengers, because comics are all about continuity porn now, and so everyone has to be involved in everybody's business.
Very true. Yep. Yes, the thing about Quicksilver joining the Avengers in the next couple of issues, purely because he's going to be an Age of Ultron, is really shitty, but yeah.
Hey. Well, I agree that superheroes and horror as genres are very difficult to put together, because superheroes are all about power, but you're not afraid when you have power.
That was kind of the joke with Doctor Strange when he was in the Avengers. They were always inventing ways for his powers not to work.
Yeah. Have we all heard the Avengers news, by the way? I mean, the Doctor Strange news, by the way?
Benedict Cumberbatch, what is it?
Yes, officially Benedict Cumberbatch is Doctor Strange.
It's official, is it? Officially.
Well, yeah. Marvel has not confirmed. Variety, Deadline, a bunch of other people are reporting it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm just more disappointed that means a very, very slow next season of Sherlock. simple as that. I'm not worried about, oh, Doctor Strange, okay, yeah, nice. But Sherlock, oh, now we're talking.
It is a great series.
Yes.
I really wish they would have explained how he did the whole jumping off the building thing, but, you know.
You have to... They told you. Three different ways. You have to make your own decision.
Flammery. That's how they did it.
The Lady and the Tiger. The audience gets to decide. Yes, yes. Sir.
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, well. So, Benedict Cumberbatch, he's the new Doctor Strange. Okay. That's okay, I guess. Is it just me, or is Constantine the only wizard who can maintain a long-running comic book? Because Doctor Strange can't, Doctor Fate can't.
Well, no, let's be fair. Doctor Strange had... what, like 100 issues or something? I mean, he's no slouch.
Was that back in the day when, like, Jack Kirby was drawing him?
Steve Ditko?
Yeah, Ditko.
Yeah, Ditko. The Jackson Greece series, they had the Strange Tales stuff that he was always the first
Strange had to make it at least 10 years with a solo comic before it got canceled.
Yeah, so he's not ongoing these days, but let's be honest. I mean, what book is ongoing? They renumber everything like every year.
Yeah.
So,
if you make six issues, I think you're happy to.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, the longest running horror book other than Constantine would have to be Hellboy.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Point.
Is it Hellboy or is it Tomb of Dracula?
Well, that's a good
question. DT trivia, all right.
Or House of Mystery or House of Secrets, because those were out for a very long time.
Well, Hellboy went about 60 issues.
Uh-huh.
So that I don't know what the other ones' runs were. I don't know how long Dracula went.
BTRD is on 130 issues now.
Oh, yeah. Well, see, one of the things about this, though, is that these 70s titles, and I'm a big fan of Tomb of Dracula and all of the House of Mystery and all those...
Mm-hmm.
They were operating in a different kind of commercial environment, right, where there was not so much expectation of month-to-month sales. The sales were higher. Everybody's sales were higher, and there was less fear of cancellation.
Well, that was back when Dazzler was outselling Superman, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Well, there's a very specific reason why Dazzler's numbers were that high. It has to do with the 70s and Marvel's financial situation.
And disco, right?
No. It had nothing to do with disco. Do we really want to talk about this? It has nothing to do with horror, unless you're horrified by Marvel's bottom line.
maybe we should say focused on horror. So, but okay. I hadn't considered Hellboy or any of the books that DT just mentioned, really. And that's
yeah. Okay, good. We'll save the Dazzler story for another day.
Indeed. That could be a whole podcast, man. What happened to such a central character at one point? Now, where is she? Is she on a team anymore?
Uncanny X-Men.
Yeah, she is, yeah.
God damn.
She's got a punk look now, and it doesn't work. I'm sorry.
Uniform.
It just
doesn't.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. If she hasn't got roller skates, not worth it.
It was a really cool concept that they tried to make her into a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent, and she had kind of a cool outfit, and then they kind of... mess that completely up.
DT, I'm amazed at this well of comics knowledge you have. Usually I fake things by, like, Googling Wikipedia very quickly during these conversations, but I got a feeling this is off the top of your head.
I read a lot of comics. I've been reading comic books since I was four.
Well, see, so DT, what's your favorite horror book?
Ah, geez, there's just so many. The one I read right now that I've been really enjoying is American Vampire. But I mean, I go back. I love House of Mystery. I love House of Secrets. DC's Ghosts was a great comic. Tomb of Dracula, Werewolf by Night, all the Marvel 70s kind of action horror comics. There was just some great stuff there.
Oh, and all of that stuff started in the wake of the Comics Code revamp.
Yep, sure did.
Because you couldn't have vampires and werewolves or zombies in any of your books until the Spider-Man drug issue led to a rewriting of the Comics Code, and now all that stuff that EC used to print but had to go out of business because they could no longer print was now valid again, and both Marvel and DC responded with books designed to specifically fill the gap that the Comics Code now opened for them.
And once Marvel and DC kind of finally broke that barrier, each with their own drug issue, DC had the Green Arrow sidekick Speedy being a heroin addict. And once they kind of did it once, and then they stepped back, and the sky did not fall, Roy Thomas was like, fuck it, we're doing Dracula comics. Bring it on.
To be fair, the Marvel crew was asked, Stan was approached by the Nixon administration to do the drug issue.
Yes, but the decision that he made when it wasn't Comics Code approved, many people were like, we can't do it now. And Stan was like, yes, we can.
Yes, we can. Yeah.
Maybe you forgot that I'm Stan fucking Lee.
so we got, it was great to get all those books. It's interesting to wonder what horror would have done if the code had not been enforced the way that it was.
It had gotten so Byzantine.
Yeah.
Byzantine.
Like Marv Wolfman. Like, you say potato, I'll say potato.
Okay. You say Constantine, I'll say Constantine.
Exactly.
I said Byzantine.
Byzantine. Nice.
Look, man, I'll say aluminium if I want to, all right?
Yeah.
Marv Wolfman, the Comics Code Authority, came to him and said, you're not allowed to talk about Wolfman. And he was like, that's my name.
Yeah,
like,
that's right.
Literally, that's how dumb it had gotten there at the end.
That is a true story. They had to defend that Marv Wolfman's name really was Wolfman.
Like, they assumed, being bureaucrats, that he was using that as a pen name as a dig at them. And he was like, look, I don't think about you, honestly. It's not you.
So, DT, tell me about American Vampire, because I've never read this book.
American Vampire is written by Scott Snyder, the same guy who writes Batman. Mm-hmm. And it's about creating a new mythology of vampires that's exclusive to the Americas. So you still have your Eurotrash vampires that come in, but you have the main vampire is a guy called Skinner Sweet. And he's an outlaw from the Old West who gets converted over and transformed into the first of his breed. And the comic book traces him and Pearl, who's his first minion, I guess, the first person he bites and converts. And they go through the decades. So it starts in the 20s with a flashback to the Old West, and I think now they're up into the 50s.
Hmm.
It's a pretty good comic.
Are you Team Skinner or Team Pearl?
I'm Team Skinner, man. All the way. I love.
How long has the book been going?
A while.
They're on their second volume right now. I think there's
taking their time.
Oh yeah, definitely.
And in a recent interview, one of the cool things that happened was just on a fluke, he approached Stephen King and said, "Hey, you know, this is my idea. What do you think?" And Stephen King responded with, "I think I'd like to help you write this."
Yeah,
They were doing alternating issues for a while.
Mm.
Wow.
Yeah, King wrote the backup story for the first six issues, I think it was, which explains Skinner Sweet's origin. And they had Raphael Albuquerque doing the art for all this time. The art is gorgeous. It's very thematic, very moody. The comic book is a lot of fun. The only other comic modern-wise that I'm actually reading that's horror, kind of, is The Sixth Gun, which is like a Deadlands game gone wild.
Yeah.
And that's a good one also, because that all revolves around six guns that were made basically for hell. And each gun has a separate power. Like one has the Fires of Perdition in it. One you can actually see the future and actually interact a bit with the past and stuff. And it's a really cool series. A lot of mythology and a lot of American mythology in it, which is kind of cool to see for a change.
Yeah.
Don't hate me. That concept kind of reminds me of a plot line from Supernatural, the TV show.
Not very far off in some ways. It's actually done better though.
Well, it's
what?
My wife makes me watch Supernatural, but I could. You know, after the first 5 seasons, I kind of wish they had, you know, said, hey, this is a great story, and we're done.
Yeah. I love the show, don't get me wrong. I really do. I'm watching it now. I have almost every season on DVD, but, yeah. It should have ended a long time ago.
They lost me when they finally killed off Bobby.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was sad. Oh, sorry.
Because I mean, I wasn't watching the show religiously or anything, but, there's a common problem in these ongoing TV series that they start off with an amazing cast, and then as the years go by, the actors get lured off to other projects, and everybody cool in the show leaves.
Yep.
You know, I was watching an interview with the folks who did The Wire, and whenever you do that, someone asked Dave Simon when there's going to be a sequel or a prequel or something, and he said, you know, the great sickness in American television is prolonging the franchise.
That's right.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we told the story. We like the story. If we go back to it now, what are we going to do? Have Bubbles go back on drugs? You know, have the have the same gang, someone take over the towers again? It's just, you know, we told the story we wanted to tell, and now we're done. So.
Since we're on horror books, and I'm remembering some great books, I have to give a shout-out to Preacher.
Oh, I hadn't even thought about that as a horror book.
Yep.
Well, God, what else would you call it?
A really
weirdness?
Really fucked up Garth Ennis book, yeah.
That, I mean, to me, that was the horror book that I read when I stopped reading Hellblazer. And Preacher was pretty horrifying. It was pretty awful stuff.
There's a lot of sex with meat.
Well yeah.
You can't say I'm sorry. I liked it, but sometimes with Garth Ennis, I'm like, wow, this is cool stuff. I'm really enjoying this. And then I come to one of his books, like The Boys.
Yeah.
I was taking it for a while and came to a certain issue, and I was like, fuck no. I think I'm done for a while.
Well, he certainly is trying to push your buttons. That's absolutely a fact. And
I like him as a writer. I like his horror comics. His war comics. If he has horror comics, too, I'd probably enjoy those. I'm not casting any aspersions, but... I'm just, every once in a while he just goes for the gross out, or he just gets deeply cynical, some of his work on superheroes, and I'm just like, I'm going to take a break for a while. But
well, I mean, you compare it to something like Hellboy, which we were all like, oh, yeah, that's such a great book. But let's be honest, there is no problem so horrifying in Hellboy that Hellboy cannot punch it in the face. I mean, it's basically that book isn't really very scary. It's beautifully drawn, but it's not particularly scary.
There are some genuinely horrifying things in Preacher. I'm sorry, DT, go ahead.
No, that's okay. The BPRD book is actually a little more horrifying.
Is it?
Yeah. Because there's, everything's kind of erupted. Hellboy's not there anymore. He's dead, technically. He's in hell. And the BPRD are basically trying to clean everything up.
If you think about the Hellboy comics, they would be really terrifying if not for the fact that there's a demon with a big whammer on his hand, right? So if you're not Hellboy, and Hellboy's not there to save you, like, think about it from this point of view of an average BPRD agent, right? This is hell that he's walked into.
Yeah.
Hey, there's a fine line. A lot of these comics we're talking about have horror elements and comedic elements.
Yes.
I mean, I guess like a lot of action movies from a certain era or a lot of horror movies do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that... from a narrative standpoint, I'm going to start sounding really pretentious here, but this is, I'm sure, only the first of many. That you need to break up the horror with moments of comedy, or else it just creates a numbness. Like, oh, it's another awful thing happening, and it starts to lose all of its impact, right? And so you need contrast, you need highs and lows. You're not going to make too much good stuff actually happen, because that would break the awfulness of the downward trajectory of your horror novel. But you can create funny moments, even black comedy, especially black comedy, right? Where something horrible happens, but it's done in such a bizarre way that it's actually kind of funny while also being horrible.
You know, one thing, one advantage comics really have over movies in terms of narrative construction and just gimmicks. I mean, there's never been a found footage horror comic book.
Right.
And I guess if I go on Netflix right now, I can find like 10 low-budget horror found footage films. You know, the children of the Blair Witch, so to speak.
Yeah.
Just 10. Crikey.
I could probably
everyone I switch on Netflix seems to be a found footage film at the moment.
And I mean, some are good, some are okay. I thought VHS was, and VHS 2 were cheesy but entertaining. But it was rare to get something that really scares you. I mean, when I first saw Blair Witch in the movie theater, and you can mock me if you want, but there were moments I was scared shitless watching that movie.
Blair Witch is pretty
weird. I fell asleep.
Yeah. You fell asleep?
What?
I fell asleep during the movie. I was so bored.
Now, the second time I saw it, I had DT's reaction. Because all the jump scares were gone, and you know there was no suspense anymore. But
the scariest movie I ever saw in the theater was the original screening of Alien.
That was a great movie.
Because, you know, I was a kid, and I thought, and I had seen Star Wars a few years before, and I thought, oh, this is a space movie. This is going to be like Star Wars. Look, it's a spaceship. Right?
Yeah, it's a spaceship.
Running back to the back row where my parents are and asking if I can sit with them.
I can sit. Well, I saw Star Wars when I was 5 years old.
Yeah.
And at that point, Darth Vader storming onto the Rebel Blockade Runner was the scariest thing I'd ever seen in my life.
Right. Well, but then wait for the scene when the chest burster happens in Alien and, you know.
Yeah, I could agree. That franchise has gone to strange places, hasn't it?
It has.
Yeah.
Now we have the alienectomy from Prometheus instead.
Anyone like Prometheus?
Yeah.
Yeah, I love Prometheus.
Yeah, it was a good movie. It was fun.
I just didn't understand at the end of it why we had an alien that was like an alien, plus a wiggly tentacle alien that wasn't an alien we'd seen before, plus another one that was potentially there as well. It just seemed to be like, okay, where did these go during the other the later films? And the other thing was, I thought it was originally set on the alien like LV-426. It's not, it's set on LV-424 or something like that. It's actually a different planet from the one I thought. I was like, okay, so this is not the ship from Alien they discover. This is another ship that's ship from Alien they discover.
I thought it was the ship.
No, apparently I double checked it, and they swear unless I've read it wrong, LV-426 is definitely the alien planet, which is where they build the placing aliens on.
Yeah.
This is LV-424 or 423 or something like that. Yeah.
So it's like two planets in the same.
Two planets over. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Have you guys seen not the to video visit. Game?
Isolation.
No, the aliens. Yeah.
The new one. I haven't played it, but it looks cool.
Yeah.
That trailer looks really amazing.
I like the fact that you can play the Nostromo crew on it.
Oh, that's great. That's genius.
They all returned. It actually has a lot of the original talent. Like Sigourney Weaver does Ripley's voice in it.
Really?
Oh, did they get Dallas?
Yeah, I think so. Tom Skerritt.
Captain Dallas. Because we're so conditioned to think that the captain is the hero of the space movie. I don't remember. When did that film come out?
70-something, right?
76, 77.
Okay, so I was
right
like...
Star Wars.
Yeah, I was like 8 or 10, right? I was way too young to be watching this movie. But you know, I saw the captain. And, okay, the captain's obviously the hero. The captain is going to win. I mean, that's what captains do. Boom, dead in the air shaft. Right?
Sucks to be him.
Well, yeah, but he wasn't Kirk. He was a space trucker, right?
I was a kid. All that mattered is that he was captain.
1979
for Alien. Okay. Just so I'd mention. Thank you for
reminding me how ancient I am. Yeah, I think I was too young to see that in the theater.
Yeah, I would have been 4, so.
I was too young to see it in the theater, too, but it didn't stop me.
My dad took the whole family.
Really?
Yeah, we all went and saw it, and I was the youngest, to be fair, but I was not the only person under 18 or whatever the age limit was back then.
Mike, the 70s were a simpler time when parents would take their 10-year-old sons to R-rated movies.
Yeah.
It happened.
If you go to the drive-in, who gives a fuck, so...
It was probably my own fault, because it was like a space movie, and I'm like, I want to go see Alien! He's like, you don't want to see that fucking film, and I'm like, yes, I do! And... So, and my dad was the guy that would say, oh, you really don't want this, but if you insist on it, let me show you why you're wrong. And then we would go, and we'd come up, and I would come home crying, and he'd be like, what'd I tell you? You were right! You were right! You know, that was my house.
So let's talk about your therapy sessions, Jason.
I think I'm having them right now, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, zombies. They're kind of a hot commodity lately, eh?
Yeah.
Yes, they are.
Plants and Zombies, iZombie, all those fucking zombie movies.
Walking Dead.
Don't forget Afterlife with Archie.
Ah, you're right. Well, hey, are zombies here to stay? Is it a passing fad? What do we think? What does it mean? Because I got all you smart motherfuckers on the line.
Well, I'm more interested in your other question.
What's that?
The people that read a lot of zombie stories and watch a lot of zombie movies, and I'm talking about all the rest of all y'all,
mm-hmm.
Do you guys think that the zombie craze has peaked? Have we hit peak zombie? Or is there more density of zombies still to come?
I mean, given that the ratings for The Walking Dead are still going up.
Yeah.
Like, they still haven't peaked. Like, the first episode of season 5 was the highest rated episode and beat football. I don't even understand how that happens.
Wow. You're right.
You make a good point. Is The Walking Dead really a horror show anymore, though?
Yeah, totally.
To the extent that it ever was, sure. I mean, it's not gory, but, I mean,
I wouldn't say Coronation Street because that's a soap opera over here. So there is a definite element to it that you would see on a regular TV series. It's not all our children or whatever.
If you're really spoiler averse and behind, I guess mute your this podcast for the next few seconds. But yeah, last week a guy woke up and his leg was gone, and the cannibals that had cut it off and cooked it were eating it in front of him. So, it's a horror show.
It's genius stuff.
All right, you make a good point. I was going to work the whole it's actually a soap opera angle. But, yeah, there's fucking cannibals, and they almost...
He starts cackling maniacally, and when they want to know what's so funny, he tells them that he's been bitten, and they're eating tainted meat.
Yep. Oh, wait, did that happen?
Yes, it totally happened.
Is that the after the credits scene?
No.
What the hell? I missed that.
Well, I think that any show like that in which the characters are at risk of death every episode, it kind of has that's a good fertile ground for horror. You know, one of the problems with television shows, especially serial television shows, is that, you know, if Dean gets possessed by a demon, we all know it's not going to last long.
Right.
Because it's Dean. Right.
Yeah.
But Walking Dead had a large enough cast that most of the cast did not have plot immunity.
And was unafraid to follow the comic where it went in terms of killing a lot of them off.
Yeah.
My wife's still waiting for Rick to lose his hand, and I'm like, it's not gonna happen.
If you look at the cast of that show in the first season, it's almost completely different.
Yeah, tell your wife that we have spoiler shots of him losing his hand.
Really?
That it's going to happen probably this season, but in a different way than it happened in the comics.
Yeah, I'm guessing the cannibals get it, but if they're not all zombies, Okay, well that's kind of freaky. Yeah, I think if I was The Walking Dead, I'd always be like, hey, Carl, Rick, maybe you guys should take point.
Yeah.
Because you guys are point of view characters, and you can't die. But everybody else, it's open season pretty much.
And that's good.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm done, please.
I was saying, you were saying that, has zombie movies peaked? If you look at cinema for the last 40 years, there seems to be a trend where something will catch with a small audience, and a studio executive will say, hey, you know, maybe if we just tweak it this much, we can reach a wider audience with it. When that tweak works...
Yeah,
they're going to milk that cow inside out until it's totally dry and then kick it until some dust comes out, and then they're done. Like, if you look at the trend that happened, you had, in the late 70s, early 80s, you had space movies, and they came out with every flavor you can imagine.
Sure.
Then they had action movies, and action movies spawned a subgenre of American martial arts movies. We really can't call them kung fu flicks because it was just guys doing moves. 99% of these guys weren't real martial artists.
Right.
So, you know, they were just choreographed. Then you get, you know, you start moving into the late 90s and stuff like that where action movies peak but then start to die down, and then you get action movies with twists. And that's where you started seeing, like, Matrix and Blade and stuff like that. And now we're into superhero movies, and people are starting to get, not sick of it, but you can see, oh, yeah, the next superhero movie's coming out. You know, so, and I think zombies are going to go the way of how vampires did, because if you look at Walking Dead, while you have Walking Dead where, you know, they're going to have their season of cannibals, you have a totally cheesy take on it, which is Z Nation, that did that episode in one episode and then they were done with it. So, I mean, you know, you get these really big stretches of high, and, you know, and everybody gets their fill of it, and then they just move on to the next thing. So when we get sparkly zombies, I think we'll be done.
That might be it.
I'm writing that book.
Well, I think someone already did. It's Warm Bodies, right?
Yeah, that was
that's true.
Yep.
Ordinary, yep. Romantic comedy with zombies, right?
Yeah.
But zombies persist. Maybe there's something about them types and something people like. I don't know.
We've had Zombieland, too, which is really a comedy more than anything.
And they're making a sequel.
Yep.
And Shaun of the Dead, right?
I do a lot of study of genres, like how genres are develop and how they evolve. There's like an early phase where you try to figure out what the rules of the genre are. And for zombie films, that would be like the Romero kind of era. And then you have an era where everyone kind of understands what a zombie movie or what a zombie show is. And because everybody understands it, you don't have to explain how it's happening anymore. You can just kind of tell other stories that presume everybody knows what you're talking about. And that's kind of sort of the classical, the kind of golden age of a genre. And then once you've sort of told all of the stories that you would normally tell in a genre, it starts to go off in crazy directions, including satire. Now, everybody understands the genre so well that you can actually make fun of it, and people will get the jokes. I mean, if you had told Shaun of the Dead in the 70s, nobody would have gotten the joke, right? And then after it's gone through the satire phase, there kind of comes this time where creative talent decides, well, can we keep it going? Can we reinvent the genre? So it's no longer the zombie story. It's like the, you know, neo-zombie movies. And I think this is actually where the zombie genre is right now. It had a golden age, and then it had this sort of satire phase, and The Walking Dead TV show and a bunch of other high-profile shows are almost trying to reinvent the genre to try and see if you can actually give it new life for another generation or so. If it works, we'll be watching zombie movies for 20 more years. But if it fails, no, people will leave the genre alone for 20 years until somebody comes back and tries to rediscover it.
Well, I mean, in a way, we already know the answer to that question, right? Like I said, 18 million people watched the first episode of the fifth season of a TV show. I mean, that doesn't happen.
That's 5 years into
a show, the ratings are still going up.
That's very impressive, but it's still a singular phenomenon. In order for it to really be to relaunch the entire zombie genre, other creators have to get involved. We have to get other shows and other films that are also that good. And then it survives. Because Walking Dead's not going to last forever. And eventually it's going to end. And when it does end, is there going to be anybody else still writing in the genre? Certainly there's a fan audience for it. There's absolutely an audience for it.
Well, okay, so you just answered your own question. If there's an audience for something, a writer, that's what writers do. Writers look for audiences.
Well, they also have to have, I hope you're right. I'm not here to bury the zombie genre. I'm only suggesting that I think that's kind of the phase where the genre is right now, is it's trying to kind of reinvent itself. And so far, I agree, it's doing a great job.
This is where independent comics, creator-owned comics, are such an important force, because the big two would have never greenlit The Walking Dead.
Right.
But Robert Kirkman could just go to Image, and he could do it himself, and he could say, you know, I think there's something to talk about here, and I think this is a great source of human drama, and because remember, The Walking Dead are not the zombies. The Walking Dead are the survivors.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so, again, that's what I mean when I say writers will find audiences. Kirkman had an idea. Mm-hmm. No one believed that it was really good except him. But the moment it got out there, the ball was rolling downhill.
Well, anybody who turned down Kirkman's Walking Dead proposal was dumb, because let's be honest, he was not a nobody when he made that pitch.
Kirkman, he was not.
Kirkman had been a nobody for a long time. That's when I met him. I met Robert when he was writing Battle Pope, for fuck's sake.
Yeah.
And I have only great respect and love for Robert Kirkman, because as I mentioned before, he published my first comics. And so I will never say a bad word about Robert Kirkman till the day I die.
And lest I give anyone the wrong impression, he never pitched The Walking Dead to Marvel. He specifically said he thinks when a creator has their best idea, they need to walk away from Marvel so they can own it.
And a lot of
people looked at him and were like, oh, that's really kind of an arrogant thing for you to say. You walked away from The Ultimates. How could you do that? And he's just like, well, you know, look.
Kirkman had been writing zombie stories. He's probably been writing it for 20 years now. Even when I met him, he was doing a zombie story. I forget what it was called. He was publishing alongside Battle Pope in his own imprint. It was called Funkotron. He wrote a couple of books at that time as an independent publisher. I forget what his zombie book was called. But he knows this genre really well. And didn't he write the Marvel zombie stuff?
He did. That was and Marvel really just kind of looked at him and were like, okay. And then the first one of those that they did, I think it was reprinted 10 times. The one with zombie Spider-Man and zombie Mary Jane in a wedding dress on the cover.
So, Chuck, you seem to have a big interest in zombies. Why is that?
I actually, for the longest time, didn't. Because on its face, right, the concept of a zombie apocalypse is deeply stupid.
Because the bears are the favorites.
It is a genre that posits that the slow, unintelligent, unarmed humans are going to overwhelm the fast, smart humans with guns. That is at its core what it's about. And anyone who wants to say it could really happen, I think there's more of a chance that the Lord of the Rings could happen. But what happened was, I had a friend who just put a Walking Dead trade in my hand, the first one, and said, just read it, and if you don't like it, you never need to talk to me again about this. And I did, and what I discovered was that it wasn't about the zombies at all. And so that was a revelation to me, because, for example, the George Romero movies, by contrast, are movies that are... They're really...
You can say they're bad, it's okay.
Those are what I would say are your satire, Jason.
Well, you'd just be lucky that McLaughlin isn't here, because he would be burning you alive right now.
Okay. To me, remember, Dawn of the Dead is about a group of people that trap themselves in a mall and then spend a good portion of the movie doing drugs and having sex. And then because they're doing drugs and having sex and being complete idiots, they wound up losing their stronghold and a couple of them flee into the night. I mean, it's really a movie that's absurdist in a lot of ways.
I would agree. So, Chuck, you've written a game.
Wow, that was the world's most blunt force segue.
We've been there for the last 20 minutes, but we keep just saying.
I've been doing subtle segues, and they didn't work, so I just, you know, charged into it.
Tell us about it.
I have not completely written a game yet, but I do have 160 pages of a game, I suppose.
So tell us all about it.
It's a game called...
Actually, we've talked about previous podcast listeners will know your game is called After Zombies. And,
game called After Zombies. And it's a continuing process.
We're going to be doing an actual play session later this week. We'll get that posted. We recorded that a couple weeks ago, and we're waiting to do session two, but John Gibbons' schedule just isn't working out, so we're just going to run session one.
Yeah.
Just putting that out there. So.
And it's a game in which I tried to do what I think is really great about a lot of the current genres of zombies, which is that it's about the interactions with the interactions between the survivors,
the group dynamics that emerge in the survival situation.
Right. Yeah. And the mental aspect, kind of it's almost a war comic. It's almost like a war genre in a way, because you're just kind of looking at people kind of getting chipped away mentally over a long period of time. Right.
Now, how is you've got a long running playtest, right?
Yeah, I have been running the game since January.
And how devastated and traumatized is your playgroup?
They've had some bad things happen to them. They've bounced back. The episode that I would say really kind of most deeply freaked them out was they had taken over a school. And they had actually been called to the school. They had gotten a ham radio broadcast from one of the students in the school. And so they pretty much reluctantly decided to go save the students. But having rescued the students, they didn't really bother to fully explore the whole place. And so, after they had been there for a couple of days, they hear a loud noise. And out of this classroom that had been barricaded closed come like dozens of zombie children, like 8 to 12. And that was a time when much mental damage was done to characters, let's say.
In the old Call of Cthulhu game, there's a sanity track, and your character slowly loses sanity fairly inevitably. Until he finally runs out and goes crazy. Do you, do you use a tracker like that?
The game actually has it has hit points, which we all know and love.
Yeah.
And then it also has a stat called mental toughness, which works very similarly to hit points. And so many of the monsters in the game are not so much physically dangerous as they are. For example, the little devil, which is the child zombie, when you even see a group of them, that's going to do mental toughness damage to your character. When you kill one, that's going to do additional mental toughness damage to your character. So when you get out of the fight, you're not going to be okay mentally.
Those points can recover, though.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's not nearly one of the things I don't like about Call of Cthulhu as a game. It very faithfully represents the books upon which it is based.
Yep.
But it is not a game I would want to run or play because it's a death spiral game.
It is.
The demise of your character is inevitable. In After Zombies, there are as many ways to heal mental damage as there are to heal physical damage. You could find a bottle of Xanax.
Right.
And that's gonna help you, you know, at least get over the hump, right?
Yeah, in Call of Cthulhu, there were only three eventual outcomes. You either went insane, you got eaten by a monster, or you got killed by cultists.
Yes.
I'm not a big fan of that game.
It's a brilliant emulation, not an immolation, an emulation of its source material.
I ran the hell out of that game in college. We actually had a group that met every Sunday morning during church.
It's a perfect time and place.
It was great. And we played Call of Cthulhu pretty much my entire undergrad career. The Candlelight Spectre Society. If anyone out there is listening, you remember who you are.
That was excellent.
Hey, you know what? That's one thing I hadn't thought about is maybe we should talk about our favorite horror games, because Call of Cthulhu was not a game I was fond of personally, but as everyone makes the solid point, it emulates that particular niche genre of horror.
Before we got rolling today, DT mentioned something about horror gaming.
Yeah.
Tell us.
Okay. There is a Kickstarter that actually has succeeded in funding for Chill 3rd Edition. For those who don't know what Chill is, like Mike...
I have never heard of it before.
Chill is, it was originally a game that was made by Paysetter Games using their own in-house system. They also produced Space Ace, Star Ace, something
like
that.
There was a time travel game too.
Yeah, there's a time travel one and there's a few other ones.
Yeah.
But Chill was really the big one, and it emulated basically your hammer flicks, your kind of monster of the week sort of thing. And in the 80s, it was bought out by Mayfair Games, and a second edition was done. Yep. The second edition was a little more serious. It wasn't as campy. They got more into the campaign world, where you're playing an agent of an organization called SAVE, which, if you've ever seen an episode of the show Poltergeist The Legacy, is very similar to that. Mm. And you basically were a normal person who basically... were sent out into the world to solve supernatural crimes and take down, you know, monsters and such. It uses a percentile system, if I remember correctly, and their fear checks is by far the best fear system I think I've ever seen for a role-playing game.
How does it differ? It's been too long. I played Chill a couple of times, but it's been forever.
It's almost... The way the fear checks works is almost similar to the way that the conditions work in Mutants and Masterminds. You would actually roll against, I'm trying to remember here, you'd actually roll against like a fear trait.
Yeah.
And depending on how well you succeed or how well you failed, determine what happened to your character.
I see.
More often than not, you kind of did the shaggy runaway where you actually broke through the door, left your silhouette behind, and ran for about 6 miles until you finally realized, wait, what am I running from?
Right.
But it was a great little game. It had a lot of potential. There were some really fun supplements out for it. The Vampires book, I remember very well.
Yeah, it got pretty well supported for a while. It had a lot of books, yeah.
It really did. I think the big failing point for Chill was when they started trying to say, well, you can play the monster.
Oh, and, yes.
And you don't need that book. There's a ton of games out that are like that.
Well, so I think that's what it was. It was a response to the whole Vampire Masquerade World of Darkness.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And if the guys from 3rd Edition are actually listening to this, don't make that book. Ever. No matter how desperate you are for sales, don't make that book.
If people want to play a monster, there's a huge set of games to play that with. Yeah,
most definitely. I mean, don't get me wrong. There's a bunch of games out there that are really good for horror, to emulate horror. But there's just something really nice about this particular game. There was something that you weren't completely helpless. But on the flip side, you weren't, like, super powerful. They did have, like, a magic/psionic system called the Art that certain characters could actually access.
Yeah.
But even that wasn't, like, you're not playing Hellboy. You're not playing, you know, Batman, you know, something like that. You're playing a guy who just happens to be a little stronger or can summon that adrenaline, you know. It was a really cool system.
Hey, you know, you guys kind of mentioned Vampire the Masquerade.
Yep.
I personally don't consider White Wolf to make horror games, because the ones I've seen played, you know, pick any one of the games, one that being played is kind of
soap opera or
spooky superheroes.
Well, of course, there's a long tradition of combining horror and soap opera that goes back at least to Dark Shadows. I think that those two formats combine well, I think. Much better than superheroes and horror do.
Yep.
Well, I think the makers of True Blood would agree with you.
Yeah, right. There you go. Another great example.
You've obviously not played in my werewolf game, where yeah. It's all tentacles and monsters and spitting acid and stuff every episode. So
there you go.
I get it. But every werewolf game I played in or heard about wound up being fuzzy superheroes at some point.
Oh, hell no. Mine was pretty... I tried to mix my vampires with my werewolves and stuff, and it was pretty cool. Like, that was one of my favourite systems for anything remotely horror-based. I was a big fan of Cthulhu as well. We played a lot of Cthulhu between Dungeon Dragon sessions, and we, even though the campaigns probably didn't last quite as long, you know, you'd probably go for an adventure and 50% of the people would be dead by the end of it, and one or two characters may go over to the next thing. I loved that game so much.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that Vampire, when it first came out, you remember that old, their old slogan, monsters we are, less monsters we become?
Mm-hmm.
That's a good horror sum up. If you're gonna make a horror game, that's a good way to do it. Like, okay, I have to do a whole bunch of little awful things so that I don't become some kind of really awful thing.
I think that's a good hook for people who really want to roleplay it. I just don't think, I think the number of people who want to roleplay it might be less than
No, I agree. There certainly is a huge kind of power fantasy aspect to those games, and other games in the World of Darkness explored that more. Like, you know, your characters, like Werewolf, was kind of more about kicking ass to me when I read it.
Werewolf is heavily combat, right? Yeah, that's why they throw the big monsters at you. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
If you were to face the Banes and stuff and anything else, you'd be flattened in 2 seconds flat, yeah.
Yeah, and Mage had some horror aspects, but it was much more about kind of a high weirdness campaign, you know, in the kind of great Kenneth Heidt style.
Yeah, I'll agree with that.
But Vampire was really the seat of horror in that. And then when they came, by the time they got to Wraith, it was like so Baroque horror. Like it was just bizarre in the kind of depths to which the horror had sunk. And I think it started to finally turn people off. But I agree with you, Mike. I think that there was an emphasis in making a lot of kind of dark superheroics rather than horror. But
mm-hmm.
And we see that in films too, right? Like you know, what are the movies about the vampire werewolves?
Underworld.
Yeah, the Underworld series. Yeah. Those are superhero movies with fangs.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to say Twilight. You see how I didn't say Twilight?
See, I nearly said that. Yeah, because I thought it was
Twilight. Because by the last movie of Twilight, they're wearing capes.
Let's
this huge super monster battle, and they're wearing capes. I mean, it's openly a superhero movie by that point.
Let's be fair, actually. Twilight is just fan fiction for the X-Men. Come on.
Yeah.
Because they all have different powers. They're all taught by one person. Come on.
Yeah.
You know?
You might run into something there, actually. Well, hey, I'm going to do something I usually don't do on this podcast, because it tends to not be the best open-ended question, but it's something I'm always curious about is, I'm sure most of you guys here run games, and Chuck, I know you're running one right now. How do you get a sense of horror at the gaming table? You know, people are eating their Cheetos, drinking their Mountain Dew, rolling their dice, telling their dumb Star Trek jokes. How do you take that environment and inject, you know, an actual scare into it? Or do you?
Well, for myself, in the first place, I don't think... And people disagree with me on this all the time. But I do not believe in trying to make your gaming table something it's not. And maybe this is because I'm a grognard, but everything you just described to me sounds like a game. I don't want to turn the lights down and play spooky music and, you know, have sound effects cued on my phone. To me, all that stuff is just dumb. If you want to scare your players, well, in the first place, it depends. Do you want to scare your players or do you want to scare the characters? Scaring the characters is easy if you have a game that mechanically supports it. Scaring your players, now, then there are things, you know, there are buttons that, you know, you can push. I went out of my way. I was running a Star Trek game for a group of players, and one of my players was, she's a very maternal person, and I knew that this would disturb her a bit. Like, obviously, I wasn't going to try to cross the line and offend anyone, but I had them encounter a Trill freighter where all the Trill had basically been gutted. Their symbiotes had been stolen.
Oh.
And I knew that was really going to just a bit set her teeth on edge and really make her want to find the people that did that. And so there's all kinds of things that you can do, right? Because you're telling a story.
So, I think a lot of it comes down to the quality of player also, because you're going to have some people who are, you know, who are just in it to, you know, let's go get the treasure or let's defeat the bad guy and let's just get this done. And then you have some players that really want to emulate what they're playing. You know, I found that, I mean, I've run horror games for years, and whenever I run a horror game, I found that the players that really want to play horror want to emulate the genre.
Yes.
You don't get too many people who want to play horror who are like, you know, why can't we play Pokemon instead?
Yeah, your players have to want to be scared.
Yep.
If they don't want to be scared, then you're doing what Chuck was doing. You're trying to turn the table into something that it's not.
Yep.
And I only have to, for a minute, I have to stick up for those people that want to just kill things and take their treasure, because I don't think that's a worse kind of role playing.
No.
But I do think that it's a different style of role playing. And I absolutely agree with you. Your players have to want to be there. And if they want to be scared, they will help you scare them.
Mm-hmm. Most definitely.
I remember one time when I was running the Call of Cthulhu game, and it had transformed to the modern era. And I sent the players, they were on like a beach. And one of the players said, all right, well, I take the flashlight. And then I say, okay, I'll be right back. And then I walk down the beach all by myself. And everyone else is watching him go. And then he says, okay, now I shake the flashlight and drop it. Right? Make everybody think that he'd been attacked by the monster. It was just funny. It was just a humorous moment. But the point is that the players will buy into the genre. And they will try to help you. I have found that, in my experience, the most effective kinds of horror at the gaming table are not the gruesome kind of physical horror.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I find that the kind of existential horror is more interesting for me at the table. And I'm talking about characters, like when you fear your loss of identity, when you fear your loss of self.
Yep.
I remember one of the most interesting moments at my table was when these people are just—they're just playing their regular characters. But at the end of the session, they had bumped into other creatures that they thought were shapeshifters, and the shapeshifter had taken over the identity of two of the player characters. But by the end of the session, it was revealed that actually the quote-unquote shapeshifters were the real player characters. And the player characters the players have been playing all session were actually the shapeshifters. and when I described two of the player characters as melting and saying, oh no, I must be this other person, and they change before their eyes and leave, that gave me, like, you know, just one little sharp moment of, wait a minute, who's actually playing who in this game?
Mm-hmm.
And what if
Spider-Man was his clone all along?
Yes, exactly.
Well, yeah, a lot of times, you know, something spontaneous will happen, right? That will suddenly, you have a hook. I had sent a group of players to Ravenloft one time,
yeah.
And they really weren't they really weren't into it. They you know, had kind of heard some things about Ravenloft,
yeah,
which, you know, Ravenloft had a very deserved reputation in some ways. And so mostly what they wanted was to get home. Yeah. But along the way, they get attacked. And one of them, without thinking, used his Cloak of the Bat. So you're in a town where Strahd von Zarevich's castle looms in the distance, and someone, a stranger in an inn, turns into a bat, and the entire town, and that was just something that, like, the moment he did it, like, two of the other players turned to him and were like, "What did you do? do you realize what you just did?"
Yeah.
Yes.
Great. Nice.
And so that was just a, you know, the players had handed me a gift on a silver platter, right?
And Chuck's observation about his player that had kind of strong maternal instincts is another great tip, because there's a reason why the Hobbit is filled with evil spiders.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because Tolkien's son was terrified of spiders. And that was the audience for the story.
Right.
So find out what your players are afraid of,
yep,
and they will totally buy into it.
Well, cool. That's good advice. Well, hey, we're getting kind of close to where we should wrap things up. Any other subjects you want to touch on before we close?
Yes, I got through the whole episode without having to explain why I don't like The Walking Dead. I'm so proud of myself.
Too late. Dance, Jason, dance.
I laugh when you wrote me that. When you said, "Dance, Jason, dance," I did laugh. I have to admit. Nope.
Okay. We'll remain in suspense, although I think you've covered that in a previous podcast at some point.
I mentioned that I was not a fan of the zombie genre, yeah.
Okay, cool.
No, this cannot stand, Jason. Defend your objectively wrong taste. Go.
Nice intro. Well, with that, I've already lost the fight, so no.
Boring.
Besides that, Mike has to go work for his corporate pay desk.
No, at this point, I'm going to be picking up the kid from daycare and making dinner, but it's okay. I can wait a little bit. So we can talk about that, Jason, or we can ask Walt if there's anything he wants to expand on.
There you go, Walt.
Just to touch on what Jason was saying real quick, the loss of the expected role, like when you were talking about aliens with the captain, turning the players on their head and saying, "No, you're not the hero of the story. In fact, run, bitch." I mean, that can instill some dread at the table. But there's a bunch of really cool horror stuff going on right now, like Zack Snyder is doing Witches. And that's really, really creepy. You got Valiant Comics doing the death-defying Dr. Mirage, who is, here's a person who can talk to the dead, and the only person who's dead that she wants to talk to, which is the husband she lost, she can't reach. You know, it's a really interesting supernatural take on the whole medium. And what,
I read that book that said it was really good.
It's really, really good. I mean, you have The Second Life of Dr. Mirage, which was the series that took place at the old Valiant Comics. And this is like years late. This takes place years later where that Dr. Mirage is dead and his wife has taken up the mantle. And, it's creepy in a way that, you know, if you've ever lost somebody, you can kind of identify with it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a lot of good horror stuff going on right now. And it seems like that's where a lot of the indie comics are going. They're going toward horror-centric type stories because, you know, I mean, we have superhero stories going on every which way, so why not tackle that?
Well, when Hellblazer ended, I mean, it created a vacuum. It created an audience, right, Chuck? And so if there's an empty audience, then some creator's going to fill it.
It didn't create the audience. The audience was already there.
Well, you know what I meant.
Writers find audiences, yes.
You know what I meant. That's what I meant.
Okay. Don't take that tone with me, Jason.
Alright, so when we do show up to Dragon Con, we gotta film the meeting of Chuck and Jason.
You know I love you, Chuck. I can never say
absolutely.
Chuck, I owe Chuck a huge debt of gratitude and I will never forget it.
So, DT. Oh, Jason, you have something else?
No.
Okay, DT, you've been quiet for the last few minutes. Anything else you want to bring up before we wrap it up?
Just the thing I always say, check out Axe of Villainy. we just got done doing some horror-themed characters. So.
Oh, nice.
We have, I actually, for October, we did the Mother Maiden Crone bit. So, always check that out.
are those villains like all collected into one single book, or are they all separate PDFs, or how do I buy that?
They're all separate solo issues at the moment. I'm working on the first collected volume as time permits.
I see. And how long is each one? Just a couple of pages, or?
Yeah, just a couple pages for 99 cents.
Yeah.
Okay. So right on.
If a listener wanted to find that, I guess the smart move is go to RPG Now or drivethroughrpg.com, search for Acts of Villainy, and
Acts of Villainy or Zion Studios.
And you get cool villains for just a buck you can use in your Mutant Masterminds Third Ed game.
Yep. And if you're in the mood for Mad Science, we've got that coming up in November.
Okay. If you're not in the mood for Mad Science, what's wrong with you?
Indeed. Yeah,
exactly, right?
So you guys are doing a full Mad Science supplement, or...?
We're actually covering our kind of super science bad guys known as Hades.
Oh, okay.
It's actually going to be a group, and then there's going to be a couple of solo issues that are going to tie into that.
Okay, cool. Sounds good. Aid, anything from you?
Not a lot. As some people have seen on my Facebook thing, I am working on a comic which is a supernatural version of the Rockford Files, but with a koala in the starring role rather than James Garner. So that might be coming soon. We should see how that's progressing. That will be slightly horror based, as we are talking about horror. So there are monsters and various other tentacled weird monstrosities in it. So that's kind of cool.
Hey, I would not have even thought you old enough to remember the Rockford Files.
Oh, I love the Rockford Files. I'm a massive Rockford Files fan.
My stepfather watched that show religiously every afternoon when I came home. It would be on, and that's how I got exposed to it. I still remember the answering machine opening.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. It's a fantastic show.
Well, I officially love your new comic.
So, hey, two questions. Number one.
Yeah.
Am I not keeping you busy enough? And number two, when are you kickstarting this?
When am I kickstarting this? Probably, I don't know if it will get kickstarted. I'm doing it on my off time, and that's why it's incredibly slow at the moment. That's why I'm only 5 pages into it. The script is written for the first issue. The second issue is kind of plotted, but not quite there. So it's going at its own pace. Obviously, some people wanted to see what it was like, so I posted some pages online, and that's kind of motivated me to kind of speed up the process slightly quicker than it was going at the moment. So we shall see. I don't know what will happen. Like I say, I think if people are interested, I may try and kickstart it and get a printed version, or just, well, I don't know. It'll be a 99-cent PDF, and that'll be it. Done.
Can we get a link to some of these images in the show notes or something?
Yeah.
There is something on Facebook about it. So.
Okay, good.
Cool, we can do that. All right, yeah, because I remember seeing Banjora. He emerged as an Icons character in one of our products.
He was an Icons character, yes, for the playtest we did, and then he got put as a character as a backup. Yeah, so he was just too cool to not use. So, yeah.
Yeah, I really think you should kickstart that once you get it. Once you get an issue finished or something, because I would pay for that.
Cool. Well, that's one. I have my Kickstarter target of $3.
I would kick in more than $3. I'd kick in $5.
Yeah, that's cool. Excellent.
All right. Well, hey, anybody else? Chuck, anything from Mayfair you want to remind us of?
It seems appropriate to this podcast. Mayfair has a new board game out called Villainy.
Oh.
Which is a game where all of the players play aspiring supervillains.
Hmm.
And they all want to be kind of the number one supervillain in the city. So in the early stage of the game, you're going to be committing crimes and recruiting henchmen. And then you're going to commit, be the first player to win the game by committing 3 increasingly difficult crimes leading up to your magnum opus. And your magnum opus might be something like you're going to make all the rainbows in the world black and white. Or you're going to your nemesis in the game is a superhero named Fantastiman, and one of the magnum opuses in the game that you can do to win the game is you're going to publish his browser history onto the internet.
That's cool.
Or you're going to decaffeinate the world coffee supply. So it's a very Dr.
Bastards.
Horrible.
Yeah,
that is.
I was waiting for Walt to chime in on that one.
Yes, that is the closest the game gets to true evil. But it's a very Dr. Horrible-esque, except without the very dark third act. I guess is the easiest way to describe it. And it's a very lighthearted, cool game where you're all trying to be the number one villain in town. So.
Wow, that is pretty cool. I just posted a link into the chat box for Skype, and we'll get a link in the show notes as well.
Yeah, that seems very audience appropriate.
Yeah, definitely. All right, cool. Well, hey, definitely check that out, and thanks to all of our listeners, and we will check you out next time on the Banff Podcast.